so what I, this is what I did last night. I went to the launch party of an album that came out 50 years ago.
That is a great
And it was the launch party of an album that I wrote an entire book about, yeah, about 15 years ago. And the album is The Kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society by The Kinks. It is my favourite record. Anyway, so last night I got to go to this launch party, even though I was told about an hour beforehand that Ray Davies wouldn't be entirely happy if he learnt that I was there. So that was a, wow. So that was that's all right. I mean,
did he not like the book then?
I didn't even know then that he'd actually read the book, but that proves that he has read the book, and I'll take that. Yeah. Everybody falls out with Ray Davies; it's absolutely fine. So this album came out on the same day as the White Album by the Beatles and Electric Ladyland by Jimi Hendrix. Wow. And the White Album went to number one all over the world. Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland, huge records.
I missed the year, what year?
1968, 50 years ago.
We always go to number one.
Village Green Preservation Society by the Kinks charts nowhere in the world. Hardly sells any copies at all. Wow. Nearly finishes the Kinks' career. Is a terrible flop. 50 years later, they have the launch party for it. And there, in the room, at the same time, were Ray Davies, his brother Dave Davies, their drummer Mick Avery, not the bass player who plays on the record because he's dead, but John Dalton, his replacement bass player, even Barry Wentzel, the photographer who took the picture on the front cover, was there.
How old's he?
They are all old. Let's not mince our words. Also, it must be noted, it was tremendous fun.
Is Autumn Almanac on that album?
It was recorded in the run-up to that album. It's not on that album. But that's why we had Autumn Almanac as our special autumnal... One of the reasons we had it as our special autumnal theme music today. So that's what I've been up to. You just moved house.
As anybody knows, you don't just move house. You leave one house and feel very, very pleased that you've managed to do that. And then you face the nightmare of the moving into the other house, which is essentially just a room after room. I've never done the from the big to the small before, but from the big to the small just means boxes everywhere. It's like one of those really difficult puzzles where you have to move one bit in order to create enough space to do another. I say this with some pride. I plumbed in the washing machine last night.
Oh, okay.
Not something I'd ever thought I'd have to do. But
man,
yeah,
great bear of a man.
Well, it was.
Come out of
it, was, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was. I ran some washing and it works, but it was. Yeah.
Should we say, Nikki, what we're doing?
I think so.
I mean, we are. I have to say, everybody, this has been a stressful week. Today has been beyond stressful. I thought I was being mildly stressed that I'd left my notebook at home with all my Louis McNeice notes, but that is just nothing as to what we discovered when we got to the office, which is we think, I'm putting this out there, I'm hoping it's none of you, but we think people have stolen our podcast kit. We came in today, we have a Tibetan blanket that we always have to damp down sound. And underneath that, there is usually microphones and a mixing desk, and they'd all gone. I mean, masses of computer equipment in the office that hadn't gone. I'm wondering whether it's, you know, lit friction or the LRB
it's
podcast.
Sabotage. Yeah. Sabotage. Yeah,
have actually decided that they've just had enough.
Anyway, the reason if you're able to hear this, we're projecting it to you with our minds. That's how we've recorded it.
It's been quite a challenge to get together this podcast for one reason or another. So we were determined not to let it go. So if the sound quality is less than, if it's suboptimal, well, frankly.
That's telepathy for you.
Yeah. We're recording this quite literally on our iPhones.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us staring out into the autumnal gloom, fretting about the onset of war, shoring fragments against our ruins. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today is Samuel West, actor, director and narrator, most recently on our screens as Geoffrey Ponting in the film adaptation of Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach, and as Anthony Eden in the Oscar-nominated Darkest Hour. And also, I think all right-thinking people agree, the definitive Leonard Bast.
Yes.
Oh, you're could very kind.
Could you give me just a little bit of Bast?
Oh, right.
Careful.
His voice is something like this. It's slightly nasal. It's slightly South London, where I grew up. And his people are agricultural labourers from
That's right.
But no, now he's sort of second generation South London from somewhere near Vauxhall. So he talks a bit like this.
When I kept a blog when I was writing The Year of Reading Dangerously, when I was doing the reading for it, I didn't do it under my own name. I did it under the name Leonard Bast.
Did you?
And I used a little screen grab of you with your bowler hat and moustache as my avatar for that. So if you could speak exclusively in that voice. We're also joined by Sophie Ratcliffe, writer, critic and academic, associate professor of English at Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, editor of P.G. Wodehouse's Letters, and her new book, The Lost Properties of Love, subtitle, An Exhibition of Myself, is out from William Collins in February next year, right? Yep.
This isn't your Knickers book, is it?
It emerged from the Knickers book, John. Its working title, it was Anna Karenina's Handbag, and it was going to be about such things, but it's become something a bit different along the way.
You first told me about that, I mean, many, many years ago.
Yeah, it's been a long time. It's about the things we hide, really, like...
In handbags, or...?
Well, it's about the things we hide, like grief, childhood bereavement, love affairs.
Knickers.
And the stuff in the bottom of your handbag. Mm. And you know, Nabokov said what was in Anna Karenina's handbag just before she threw it away, and I was always haunted by that idea.
It's a good acting question, that.
Yeah.
What's in your handbag?
And when I turned 40, I remember looking in my handbag, trying to find anything at all, and just putting out this sort of bit of shrinky dink and old tampons and all this stuff. And so it's sort of a book that's come out of lists of things we carry around.
The book we're here to talk about today is a first for us. It's the first time we've done on Backlisted a poem, a book-length poem. And the book is Autumn Journal by Louis McNeice, published by Faber and Faber in 1939, but written kind of more or less in real time between August and December 1938.
But before we get on to it...
But before we get on to
John, what have you been reading this week, if you've had time to read anything?
To be honest, it has been a challenge, but I have read, I think, a short, quite brilliant book called OK, Mr. Field by Catherine Killerly. Catherine Killerly is South African by birth, a poet, and has been based in the UK. She came to University of East Anglia as a creative writing student, and this is her first novel. I'm not gonna go on much about it, except to say that it is. I think it's going to take its place in that sort of the small novels that will be talked and written about for years. You know, So Long, See You Tomorrow. Mm. Thomas Bernhard is what it comes to. It's a study in isolation. The story is very simple, kind of quite disturbing. It's a concert pianist, Mr. Field, who fractures his wrist in a train crash on the way back, and after that can't really play properly. He can play, but he doesn't play terribly well. He is the sort of person who, you know, you can't really... He doesn't want to play badly. And then he ends up... What it's really about, it's about art and being good at art and then not being good at art. And then it's about he goes back to South Africa where he purchases a house which is a facsimile to in every detail of Le Corbusier's Villa Savoy on the South African coast. And he goes with his wife Mim and to recuperate and to try and rebuild his life. And from then on, more or less everything goes wrong. Mim disappears. It's jet black, this book. You have absolutely no idea where the story is going to take you. I'll read you a tiny little bit, just so you get a bit of the idea of the voice. This is the bit about when the accident. The sleep I fell into was heavy, like the temporary shutting down a computer does when it goes into sleep mode to conserve energy. I missed my stop. Also, I fallen asleep earlier, and part of my stressful day, I fell asleep earlier on a bus. And I'd already chosen this as the bit of, I don't know whether it's life imitating art or what. I missed my stop and several after it and woke to a loud bang and everyone talking and shouting at once. I remember someone picked me up and carried me like a dog up a long escalator. Lovely. I remember a tide of commuters climbing over turnstiles. The next thing I remember is coming to in a hospital ward with my left arm bandaged to the elbow. "You were in an accident," said the doctor at my bedside. "But don't look so worried. I'm not going to cut off your hand." He laughed, and the nurse beside him laughed too. Even the patient in the adjacent bed, whose head had until now been dropped forward as though he were asleep, started laughing, though he may have been coughing. I couldn't be sure because he covered his face with his hands. The bones of my left wrist had splintered, I was told, and were now held together by a metal pin, the presence of which, since I couldn't see it, though the bandage confirmed its existence, infected everything with a gothic atmosphere, making the bloody gauze which the nurse lifted from my skin, hissing through her teeth, look like a stringy spiderweb spanning the lips of the cut, and the fluid seeping from a stitch looking like oil oozing from a grotesque sausage. The accident must have been in the news because I heard two nurses smoking in the covered walkway outside my window talking about it. "It must have been suicide," one was saying, "because the driver died with his hand on the accelerator." "What's inconceivable to me," said the other, "is the wad of cash in his pocket. He'd withdrawn it to buy his daughter a car. Who kills himself when he's planning to buy his daughter a car?" The first nurse looked at a cigarette as if it had suddenly become distasteful. "Yes," she said, "but who drives into a brick wall and doesn't cover his face with his hands?" "Anyway," said the other, "life is short and then you die. Sometimes I wish I were just a train driver so I could drive around all day listening to music." I mean, it's...
Very good.
Yeah, original. So, Andy, what have you been reading this week?
Well, you know what I've been reading this week.
It's a book
I've been waiting for 3 years, 4 years to come out. So, I've been reading the novel Francis Plug, Writer in Residence by Paul Ewan, the sequel to 2014's Francis Plug, How to Be a Public Author.
Have either of you read the...
Exaggeration, and from a position of expertise, that Francis Plug, How to Be a Public Author by Paul Ewan is the funniest novel published in the UK in the last 10 years.
Okay.
It is an absolute masterpiece, that book. I did an event in the summer with the writer Matthew de Baitre, and he defined the difference between... We were talking about what, you know, the difference between, do you call yourself a writer or do you call yourself an author? And he said the difference is the writer is the guy who writes the books and the author is the guy who goes out and does this shit. Right? And what Francis Plug, How to Be a Public Author, about is the authorial role of going out. And it's not only extremely funny, it's also the most accurate depiction of the complicity of authors, publishers, bookshops and audiences in creating these weird spaces of public worship of private grief.
Right. Although you two have got to be two of the best perspectives on this book that could possibly exist.
I will say that I know it's very in, and I know it appeals to a lot of things that I find funny, but I find them funny because I recognise the truth in them. They're, you know. Anyway, this is his new book. It's called Francis Plug, Writer in Residence. In the last book, for reasons that we won't go into in depth, Francis Plug, a wannabe writer, is writing a manual for authors to how to behave in public. And one of the ways he's investigating how to do this is by going to events, stealing the wine, approaching the authors, getting them to sign their first edition copies of Booker Prize winning novels. So as the book goes on, reproduced in Francis Plug, How to Be a Public Author, and again in the new one, are the front title pages of books that the author Paul Ewan has gone and got signed at an event. There's one by John Mullen to Francis Plug with best wishes. And what Francis Plug does is he writes down what the authors say to him, and this is autofiction as comedy. For instance,
it's so good.
Here is Francis Plug meeting the late Doris Lessing. Page 140. When the journalist camping outside her home informed her of her Nobel Prize win, Doris Lessing, stepping out of a cab, said, "Oh, Christ. Francis, when I win the Nobel Prize for Literature, I'm going to say, shit a brick." Doris Lessing, "Good for you." Francis, "Or are you shaking my shit?" Doris Lessing, "That's a new one to me." Francis, "Or, oh my God, that there is some crazy shit you spouting out of your mouth." Doris Lessing, "Okay, yes." Francis, "Or, what the shitty shit?" Doris Lessing, "Yes." Francis, or, Doris Lessing, "Shall I sign these other people's books while you keep thinking?" So as the book goes on, you have a series of cameo appearances by famous authors. However, Francis has had his book published, and it's published by the same publisher as Paul Ewan, Galley Beggar. So the publishers of Galley Beggar features as characters in this novel. He's got a job as a writer in residence at Greenwich University, rather like the author Paul Ewan. And he enjoys a drink, which the author Paul Ewan also does. Nina Stibbe just reviewed this in The Guardian. She said it's pure delight. Ben Myers just reviewed it, said Francis Plug is the saviour of comic fiction. There's a very famous thing we keep talking about on this podcast about the Bollinger Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction was not awarded last year because there were allegedly no funny books that have been published. So this book is as good as Volume 1. I hope he goes on and writes another one. They're absolutely wonderful. They're incredibly funny. No, in fact, it's not just that. They are both very funny and very depressing, which is the two best qualities any book can have. He runs them side by side. I'm just going to read another little bit, if you'll humour me. This is Francis meeting the veteran American novelist Paul Auster.
Veteran.
"Due to the unusual seating arrangements, I find myself sat almost side on to Paul Auster at the same raised level as the stage. Sitting forward with legs tucked beneath his chair, his side..." Sorry.
We've lost him.
Sorry, I'm trying my best. "His side profile resembles the ready orange zigzag on Ziggy Stardust's face. He's a surprisingly tall man, Paul Auster, and although he's just turned 70, there's a sense of Buzz Lightyear about him, helped by a similar physical stature and bold determination." And so the thing that's so brilliant, the iconoclasm of this is the point of what I was saying earlier. You would not, should not describe the great Paul Auster, and he is great in these terms, and yet they're not entirely disrespectful. They're playing off the idea of Paul Auster as much as the real person, right? "He normally steers clear of these events," he says, "but is embracing his current tour and enjoying it. At his signing, I say, I'm sorry, but I find that very hard to believe. Paul Auster, why's that? Francis, are you kidding? Look at all these people. What a frigging nightmare. Paul Auster, well, yes, but it's not something I'm pushed to do very often. FP, what about pushing buttons on your chest? Do you do that? Paul Auster, what do you mean? Francis, like Buzz Lightyear does. Do you know him? You bear a strong resemblance. Paul Auster, name rings a bell. FP, he has wings attached to his arms. Paul Auster, has he? Francis, yes, he has. And his sights are ultimately set on the universal good of humankind. Paul Auster, well, I suppose there are worse doppelgangers. FP, did you notice the garage door behind you during your talk? Paul Auster, garage door? FP, yes. It was like you were being interviewed in my old house. or just outside it. Paul Auster, pause. I see. Well, thanks for coming. FP, oh, speaking of my garage, would you be okay staying in it for the Greenwich Book Festival? Paul Auster, sorry? FP, the Greenwich Book Festival. You've been specially handpicked to attend. Paul Auster, I hadn't heard about that. Like FP, don't worry, it's all been sorted. Out of interest, how many air miles do you have? So what I'm saying, that is a very, very funny book. It's called Francis Plug, Writer in Residence. It's published by Gallibega. They're an independent publisher.
Who we love.
Who we love, who deserve your support, as does Paul Ewan.
We've talked about books enough. Now for some capitalism.
So there we are. Look, we've burnt off some of the anxiety, only a little bit of it. As we've got rid of all laughter, so we can turn to...
Although then we can go to the anxiety, which is... Turn to good account, which is Autumn Journal by Louis McNeice.
Sam, Autumn Journal, can you remember where you were or who you were the first time you read Autumn Journal?
Yes, I can. I was a very early version of me in Oxford, in Lady Margaret Hall, where I studied English. And I turned to my rather falling apart edition of Faber Collected Poems of Louis McNeice and found in the front Samuel West Oxford, November 85. So that's sort of autumn.
God, we were there at the same time.
Oh, I didn't know that. And I was in a...
85 was the year I
was reading it. I was 83 to 86, but...
I was 85 to 88, so it was first year of my three-year degree. And I was in an English set with Michael Gove. Don't know what happened to him.
Jesus God.
But I discovered this poem which kind of hit me with the force of a bullet, really. It seemed very chatty and personal. And it talked about some stuff I didn't really understand. But then it talked about love in ways that I did understand and wished I could understand better. And as somebody who was a bit of a late starter, sort of set the bar of honesty and reality and in love and personal relationships sort of high, but not so impossibly high that you didn't think you might one day be able to clear it. It's been a more or less constant companion ever since, actually.
And you recorded a version, didn't you, in early sort of 2002?
Yeah, is that sounds about right.
With music by Gary Yershon.
Gary Yershon, who is now an Oscar-nominated composer. He got nominated for his beautiful score for Mr. Turner, Lee film. Yeah, he wrote the beautiful... it's a sort of harp quintet, I think, string quartet and harp. And there's some sound effects in the background, not many. And I read about half the poem, probably. Quite a lot of the early chapters and the last couple. And then quite a lot of people wrote to me, this was before iPlayer, saying, I really enjoyed that, when can I hear it again? And I said, search me, I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
But apparently it can be found legally or illegally online nowadays, and it is repeated on 4Extra occasionally.
We'll put a link up to it on our website, because if people have or haven't read the poem and want an introduction to it, it seemed to me a perfect way in.
That's nice of you to say.
What I loved about it was that you captured there's just a vulnerability about this poem which I like you go back to time and time again, and it still feels like it was written yesterday. It's an extraordinary thing.
Sophie, where were you when you... Can you remember the first time you became aware of Louis McNeice, his work, or just his name, or in passing?
I can, because I remember I was at school. It was in a poetry anthology that we had as one of the first years of GCSE, and it was a lovely anthology called Touch with Fire, which had some incredible poems. And really, actually, that's why I fell in love with poetry and decided to do my job, this one anthology. But I remember I remember the poem and thinking, that's a funny name or an unusual name, and I was going to get the E and the I wrong. I knew it. Yeah. It was an unexpected arrangement of letters. It was a poem in the anthology called Les Sylphides. And I remember being struck by the first line, which was, life in a day, he took his girl to the ballet. And trying to work out how that sounded, the sort of day in ballet, you had to do something with the second word to... And it finishes as if I remember, it just falls off the end. And he took to go to the ballet, and it says something like, being short-sighted, he could hardly see it. And so it was my introduction to Bathos. It's just like, what, and that, and the, yeah, and the poem itself falls off the end. It you expect it to finish with a bang, and it goes out with this whimper. It's about a marriage going wrong and becoming jaded. And I remember enough about the thinking, this is different. And to make poetry out of the art of sinking in poetry, and that's what I sort of remember as a smaller me.
I'm just going to read, we have a very starry backup for today's ballast.
Do we?
I'm going to read Alan Bennett's description of the career of Louis McNeice, because I think it's worth, we normally wouldn't do it this way round, but I think it's worth putting this in the minds of listeners before we then move on to talk about the work and about Autumn Journal in particular. So this is from a book called Six Poets, Hardy to Larkin, which was republished by Faber a couple of years ago by Alan Bennett. Mm-hmm. McNeice is one of the six poets that he talks about. There's a couple of little bits in here that I'll share with people as we go on. But here's his description of McNeice's life and career. Louis McNeice was born in Belfast in 1907, the son of a bookish Church of Ireland minister, a bishop-to-be. Academically precocious, he was already writing verse at seven around the time of his mother's death. He was educated in England at Sherborne and Marlborough. At Merton College, Oxford, he made the acquaintance of Auden and Spender and published his first book of poems, Blind Fireworks, in 1929. He worked subsequently as a translator, literary critic, playwright, autobiographer, BBC producer and feature writer. In 1941, he was appointed scriptwriter-producer in BBC Radio's features department, where he worked until his death. Letters from Iceland, 1937, was written in collaboration with Auden, and subsequent collections include The Earth Compels, Autumn Journal, Plant and Phantom, Springboard, Holes in the Sky, and Autumn Sequel. McNeice published highly acclaimed translations, including The Agamemnon and Goethe's Faust, and he scripted more than 150 radio plays, including The Dark Tower, 1947. The Burning Perch, his last volume of poems, appeared shortly before his death in 1963 at the age of 55.
That's shockingly young, isn't it?
It's certainly in terms now, that feels incredibly young, doesn't it? John, where did you first read Autumn Journal? Because I know this is a really special book for you, isn't it?
It was almost exactly the same as Sam. I was at Merton College in Oxford, which is where my niece had gone, and I was, as you do, you know, an undergraduate, I was casting around to try and find something slightly different. I'd been casting around, looking at slightly lesser well-known First World War poets like Ava Gurney, Isaac Rosenberg, David Jones. Mm. And you come to the poets of the 1930s, and you've got Auden looming over the whole thing. And McNeice, I read McNeice, and I'd read some of the lyrics, which were, I thought, beautiful, and had this kind of, there's a softness to McNeice that's really interesting, a kind of a, you know, you can't get away from the kind of Yeatsian brilliance of Auden when you're reading poetry. But then I discovered Autumn Journal, and I'd been doing, you know, as you have to do Yeats, and you have to do Eliot, and you're studying 20th century poetry. And I suddenly thought I'd found my guy. With Autumn Journal, I thought, this is what poetry, my dream of what poetry could be, which is something that was, you could reflect, you could be funny, you could be non-committed, you could talk about the fact that you didn't understand things, and you could do it, and you could do it with amazing structure, rhythmic structure and rhyme. I remember the first time I read it, and the total sense of exhilaration. It's something I always pick up, and I go back to passages, and But I went back, having gone back and reread it this time, and decided I didn't want to get any McNeice kind of stuff in front of me. I just wanted to go back. And it's as we will, I hope, demonstrate, it is, I could give this book to anyone, I think, and say, if you don't believe you can read a book of a whole book-length poem.
I read this early this year for the first time, and I came to you, John, and went, I've just read this amazing book by Louis McNeice. we ought to do it on Batley. We don't often do it this way, because but I said, we really got to do it on Batley. And you went, it's my favourite poem. I went, right, we're off.
Okay. I think it is the great poem of the 20th century, for me anyway, but in English, whatever.
When I went to Iceland a few years ago, long-term listeners will recall, I took Letters from Iceland with me by Auden and McNeice, which was in fact recommended to me by someone here at Unbound. And I came back and I said, oh my God, that was so wonderful. Thank you. What a brilliant suggestion. And they said, yeah, I haven't actually read it. We've got a clip. McNeice was at Marlborough at the same time and in the same class as the poet John Betjeman. And this is a little clip of Betjeman talking about his memories of McNeice when they were at school together.
He was younger than me, but much cleverer. We were both in the classical fifth. I suppose I was a bit jealous because Louis was good at work, a clever classical scholar, and he enjoyed games, which I absolutely loathed, and games were, of course, worshipped at Marlborough. Louis, even in those days, one knew, without having to ask him, that he was a poet. He looked like a poet. He had large eyes, and he looked rather like a frightened hare, and a pale, freckled face, and a dreamy appearance, and he was always writing.
I love the idea that you look like a poet.
That's so great, isn't it?
Large eyes.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful...
He's quite a good advert for poets. I mean, he's very handsome.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story here that Bennett recounts, saying Stephen Spender tells a story how when the Soviet Union came into the war in 1941, the British ambassador, Sir Archibald Clark Kerr, thought he would give a party for British poets with a view to putting them in touch with their Soviet counterparts. Throughout his party, McNeice, sleek, dark and expressionless, leant against the chimney-piece, glass in hand, looking infinitely removed from his colleagues. At the end of the evening, Clark Kerr went up to him and said, "Is it true you were brought up in Belfast at Carrickfergus?" McNeice said, "Yes, it is." "Ah," said Clark Kerr, "then that confirms a legend I have heard, that centuries ago a race of seals invaded that coast and interbred with the population. Good night." Yes, indeed.
Wow. God, he doesn't look at all like a seal. Or a hare, I think.
But McNeice clearly had a sense of himself as a poet and a thinker and a creative person
He was a brilliant classicist and he could declaim classical verse incredibly well.
But you get that from Autumn Journal, the kind of the reflections on you know, the importance or lack of importance of classical learning in the face of, you know, the tide.
What's actually happening. Yeah, he wears it quite lightly, doesn't he?
What I feel is, in the way that, you know, that McSpawnde thing, the idea of all this sort of group of poets, he's the one that always interested me because he feels to me almost like the sort of poetic kind of opposite of Orwell. He doesn't really sign up for anything. He's too kind of clever to join the Communist Party he's Camus rather than Sartre. You know, he's what interests him is kind of the emotional truth of things. The Autumn Journal, amongst many of the things that I love about it, is that reading it at this time of year, you're reminded it is a journal. I mean, he actually does. It's a diary. Mm-hmm. It's writing through, albeit an extraordinary, that 1938 into 39 sort of descent into war, but it's about time, you know. It's about a sustained meditation in time, much in the way that Four Quartets is, but in my view doesn't have all the throat clearingly myth kitty showing off that Four Quartets has. I mean, much as I love Four Quartets, it's just there's just something about, I can't imagine anyone who is in any way sensitive picking up Autumn Journal and not finding, and also the language in it is so, you never feel that he's going, I've just been reading, which I'm enjoying, Robin Robertson's verse novel, but it's very much a verse novel, you know, and the writing is exquisite and the metaphors are exquisite, but it's with Autumn Journal, it almost kind of conversational.
When I took a holiday from Twitter recently, which I have to do occasionally, well, often, sometimes when I feel either too depressed or confounded by the p- political direction of the world or just that I'm shouting into the void, it suddenly became important to nobody but me what tweet I returned with, because I wanted to say something that was valuable or useful and wasn't sort of shouty. So on the 1st of September, I posted this. September has come. It is hers, whose vitality leaps in the autumn, whose nature prefers trees without leaves and a fire in the fireplace. So I give her this month and the next, though the whole of my year should be hers, who has rendered already so many of its days intolerable or perplexed, but so many more so happy, who has left a scent on my life and left my walls dancing over and over with her shadow, whose hair is twined in all my waterfalls and all of London littered with remembered kisses. And a lot of people liked it. And I thought, yeah, quite right too. It's
That September is hers. The her refers to Nancy Spender. She married Stephen Spender. We have a clip of Nancy Spender's reaction to reading Autumn Journal for the first time and how she felt about that part of the poem.
I had had the book sent to me from Dewey, and I was on the Underground. In fact, I was on the Northern Line going home from Charing Cross, and I was absolutely appalled when I read it. I really felt I couldn't go out again. Everybody would be sort of pointing and saying, that is the woman who left Louis, you know, that sort of thing. Well, I had to, really, because it became so claustrophobic. I never thought he was particularly handsome. Other people told me he was very handsome. I just thought he looked like a horse. He might sort of swerve violently and you'd fall off, you know, I mean, literally like a horse.
I think that's wonderful.
Amazing.
It's funny to hear her voice. I mean, this is, as Sam said, such a, it's a love poem and a meditation, and it's also he gave it to her to read, and he shoved it in her bag, and she went and she read it. She started reading it on the train, on the tube, right? Which I love the idea that the person to whom this poem was dedicated was actually read it on a train, and in the beginning.
This is the person who's inopportunely desired on boats and trains. Mm. Is that the same person?
The same person, and that she read it on a train, and the poem begins on a train. I'm rather obsessed with trains as sort of metaphors.
Your book is built around trains.
Yeah, it's
right?
Built around trains and train journeys, and the epigraph of it is from another train poem by Louis MacNeice. And I just find that it's wonderful that it made its way in underground.
I wonder if that reaction is more that people don't do things like that. You don't write about stuff like that, and not that it was a horrible thing to say, just that that their relationship, you know, washing one's clean linen in public.
I mean, we can't know. I think she felt less committed to the idea of it being this perfect moment than the poet did. But what's so wonderful, that in Canto 19...
Oh, yes. When we were out of love.
Could we hear that? Because this is
quite extraordinary. This is, you can cut this down if you like, but I'm going to have to read a page and a half of this. Yeah. Okay. Oh, what a busy morning. Engines start with a roar. All the wires are buzzing. The tape machines vomit on the floor. And I feel that my mind once again is open. The lady is gone who stood in the way so long. The hypnosis is over and no one calls encore to the song. When we are out of love, how are we ever in it? Where are the mountains and the mountain skies? That heady air instinct with a strange sincerity which winged our lies. The peaks have fallen in like dropping pastry. Now I could see her come around the corner without the pulse responding. The flowery orator in the heart is dumb. His bag of tricks is empty. His overstatements, those rainbow bubbles, have burst. When we meet, she need not feel embarrassed. The cad with the golden tongue has done his worst and has no orders from me to mix his phrases rich, to make the air a carpet for her to walk on. I only wonder which day, which hour, I found this freedom. But freedom is not so exciting. We prefer to be drawn in the rush of the stars as they circle, a traffic that ends with dawn. Now I am free of the stars, and the word love makes no sense. This history is almost ripe for the mind's museum. Broken jars that once held wine or perfume. Yet looking at their elegance on the stands, I feel a certain pride that only lately, and yet so long ago, I held them in my hands while they were full and fragrant. So on this busy morning, I hope, my dear, that you are also busy with another vintage of another year. I wish you luck, and I thank you for the party. A good party, though at the end my thirst was worse than at the beginning. But never to have drunk, no doubt, would be the worst. Pain, they say, is always twin to pleasure. Better to have these twins than no children at all. Very much better to act for good and bad than have no sins and take no action either. You were my blizzard who had been my bed. But taking the whole series of blight and blossom, I would not choose a simpler crop instead. Thank you, my dear. Dear against my judgment.
God, should we take a moment?
Wow, that was incredible. Thank you.
Thank you. So nice. Actually, I went back to this when the first person of my own age I had known all their life died. Because pain, they say, is always twin to pleasure. Better to have these twins than have no children at all. Yeah. I thought, I've got to feel this now. It was the first real loss of a person I'd ever felt. And I thought, no, this is the other side of the coin of love. And it's better that it should be this thing than that I never knew this person. And this was the first time I'd ever read that, put better than I could put it. But I'd sort of taken it in and thought, no, that's true. That's useful.
I think that profundity in McNeice that he did, but he never shows off. That's what I love about this poem. There's a sort of, you know, you don't feel that he's having to call in all that Yeatsian kind of apparatus of gyres and mythology. He goes to the heart of something that is as good as anything anybody has ever written about the end of a relationship. Mm. It's both honest and eloquent. The economy and the directness is what I love about this poem, is that it's so personal. That's the thing going back to it. It absolutely hasn't aged a jot. Every time I go back to it, you find new and brilliant stuff.
It's good when poetry is useful.
Yeah.
I remember when he was a poet laureate, Andrew Motion, talking about poetry, and people had said, oh, poetry, it's a bit up there, it's not for me. And he said, OK, do you remember when Princess Diana died and Kensington Palace was covered in flowers and stapled Queen of Hearts cards? He said most of the flowers or the cards had a few lines of verse attached. And it wasn't always very good verse, but it was the natural language that people turned to when they couldn't express their grief or sadness any other way. And it was a really good defence of poetry from somebody who's public job was to do exactly that, or part of which was to do that. And I think a lot of McNeice is like that. You think you could give this to somebody and it would be a comfort.
It's a way of composing ourselves, really, in this. But so I don't know whether there is showing off in this in the sense of virtuoso composition.
Yeah, some of the rhyming is brilliant.
But what he is showing is the dilemma of someone being in the now, almost the fear of dissolving. You were talking about the vulnerability at the beginning, and I love the fact that there's a moment when he's actually in the bath. I mean, there's a comedy. The whole poem, if it's in journal form, is that he's on a train, or he's thinking about being in Barcelona, or he's in a cafe. And there's even when he's apparently, it's a bit like Bridget Jones's Diary, he's writing in the bath. But the point at which he has this very philosophical bit about Aristotle was right to think of man in action as the essential and really existent man. He's sort of tongue-in-cheek, he's talking about himself being all philosophical. And he says, I cannot lie in this bath forever, clouding the cooling water with rose geranium soap. One can have a great affinity with the sense of how we try and pull ourselves together.
It also has the feel, as you read through it, of being something that benefited from a relatively speedy composition, because my sense as a writer, I don't write poetry, but as someone who's written and edited books, is that each canto tends to find something interesting to do with the energy left in the wake of the previous canto.
Yeah.
So he's feeling his way forward to some extent.
Mm.
Now what do I want to write about? What's the right thing here? What's the right thing to keep the energy swerving along, you know?
But I think without necessarily rereading it and thinking, how does this make a cohesive whole? It doesn't feel like he's tried to make a single poem that makes sense of one state of mind, yes, in the autumn of 1938 at all, because I don't think there was one.
This is a really interesting thing, that before he had finished it, this is a very publishing thing, John, things never change. Before he finished writing it, T.S. Eliot was pestering him for a blurb for the catalogue. So McNeice wrote for him some notes for the catalogue. And now we normally on Backlisted, we read the blurb on the back of the book, but I thought this was actually better. So this is McNeice's note to Eliot saying, this is what... Eliot said, can you give me a few pointers? He said, so, and this is what Autumn Journal is. A long poem of from 2,000 to 3,000 lines written from August to December 1938, not strictly a journal, but giving the tenor of my intellectual and emotional experiences during that period. It is about nearly everything from which first-hand experience I consider significant. It is written in sections averaging about 80 lines in length. This division gives it a dramatic italics quality, as different parts of myself, e.g. the anarchist, the defeatist, the sensual man, the philosopher, the would-be good citizen, can be given their say in turn. It contains reportage, metaphysics, ethics, lyrical emotion, autobiography, nightmare. There is a constant interrelation of abstract and concrete. Generalizations are balanced by pictures. Places presented include Hampshire, Spain, Birmingham, Ireland, and especially London. It is written throughout in an elastic kind of quatrain. This form A gives the whole poem a formal unity, but B saves it from monotony by allowing it a great range of appropriate variations. Mm. The writing is direct. Anyone could understand it. And I think it is my best work to date. It is both a panorama and a confession of faith. And that's just the blurb. Isn't that extraordinary?
I'm glad T.S. Eliot asked him for that.
Yeah. So we should say that he's funny too in this poem. I love the Birmingham. There's the Canto 8 is the, you know, to Homer in a Dudley accent. But life was comfortable, life was fine, with two in a bed and patchwork cushions and checks and tassels on the washing line and a gramophone, a cat, the smell of jasmine. The steaks were tender, the films were fun, the walls were striped like a Russian ballet. There were lots of things undone, but nobody cared, for the days were early. Nobody niggled, nobody cared. The soul was deaf to the mounting debit. The soul was unprepared, but the firelight danced on the plywood ceiling. And he was a great jazz fan. Mm. And there's a sort of almost a rappy feel to some of the stuff in it.
When you're reading it aloud, that Canto 8 is a great one to arrive at, because it just sets you off in Frankfurt.
Thinking about sort of writing, we're talking about writing in 1938, 1939, it's a time when there was lots of things coming out at this moment, it's between the acts at that moment, and Auden writing on these poems, the sense of how do you write, capture that moment. And it sort of reminded me of all the sort of rise of autofiction at the moment. We've got Nausgaard doing Autumn, and people producing, thinking, what do we do now faced with what we're looking at politically, and thinking, well, perhaps all I can try and do is capture the now and a sort of listy writing at what it might
be. I wondered, you know, Sam, you were saying about returning to Twitter, having taken a break from the noise. You know, one of the things I found about reading this for the first time earlier this year, and I slightly, you know, I say this with the proviso that I don't think one event is as bad as the other, but nonetheless, it was fascinating to read something written 80 years ago in a period of, looming national crisis, shall we say, to see that sense of time slipping away from the poet in the knowledge that something bad is coming. You don't quite know the shape.
Yeah.
You don't quite know where it will land, but you know people are waiting.
Yes.
You know, the phony war has started before the war has started. Yeah.
And that's, he talks about the importance of being honest to the present moment as he writes, even if he's got it wrong. It's just getting it down.
Hitler yells on the wireless. The night is damp and still. And I hear dull blows on wood outside my window. They are cutting down the trees on Primrose Hill. The wood is white like the roast flesh of chicken, each tree falling like a closing fan. No more looking at the view from seats beneath the branches. Everything is going to plan. They want the crest of this hill for anti-aircraft. The guns will take the view, and searchlights probe the heavens for bacilli with narrow wands of blue. I mean, everybody knows that view, and don't they? It's just
that bacilli made me think of Orwell, the people, the tube, metal tubes, people in metal tubes trying to kill, above my head, trying to kill me in Lion and the Unicorn.
I thought this what a wonderful book this is about London as well. Yeah. We've done quite a few London novels on Backlisted, but this is what part of the dream of it really is, the sense of wandering slightly untethered through these various collapsed spaces of London, how you can be in Piccadilly one moment and Primrose Hill the next.
I mean, the other thing that I love, his reflections in Ireland are, I think, remarkable. He's an Irish writer, as so many Irish writers are, writing in exile in England. There's an amazing thing in Canto 18, which I don't really feel... I can't really get, as we've got Sam here, I don't know, but there's that, sing us no more idylls, no more pastorals, no more...
Sing us no more idylls, no more pastorals, no more epics of the English earth. The country is a dwindling annex to the factory, squalid as an afterbirth. This England is tight and narrow, teeming with unwanted children who are so many, each is alone. Niobe and her children stand beneath the smokestack turned to stone. And still the church bells brag above the empty churches, and the Union Jack thumps the wind above the law courts and the barracks, and in the allotments the black scarecrow holds a fort of grimy heads of cabbage, besieged by grimy birds, like a hack politician fighting the winged aggressor with yesterday's magic coat of ragged words.
Sophie, this dovetails with something you wanted to talk about, which is an earlier poem called Train to Dublin.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. I mean, in relation to, I don't think Backlisted does poetry that often, right? And I suppose when I said I was going to talk about Autumn Journal, someone said, oh, a long poem, wouldn't want to read a long poem, and there is a sense, and this does move very quickly, and it is hugely readable. But for anyone who wants a sort of taster of it, I think this poem, Train to Dublin, is a really, really good way in, and it's even shorter. And it seems to capture this idea of being stuck in a rhythm, which is what Autumn Journal is about. How are we stuck in rhythms of thought, rhythms of habit? How should we think differently? Should we think differently? And acknowledging we are. I'll just read a bit of it, because I think it is my favourite poem ever. Our half-thought thoughts divide in sifted wisps against the basic facts repatterned without pause. I can no more gather my mind up in my fist than the shadow of the smoke of this train upon the grass. This is the way that animals' lives pass. The train's rhythm never relents. The telephone posts go striding backwards like the legs of time to where in a Georgian house you turn at the carpet's edge, turning a sentence. While outside my window here, the smoke makes broken queries in the air. The train keeps moving and the rain holds off. I count the buttons on the seat. I hear a shell held hollow to the ear, the mere reiteration of integers, the bell that tolls and tolls, the monotony of fear. At times we are doctrinaire, at times we are frivolous, plastering over the cracks, a gesture making good. But the strength of us does not come out of us. It is we, I think, are the idols, and it is God has set us up as men who are painted wood, and the trains carry us about. but not consistently so. For during a tiny portion of our lives, we are not in trains.
Oh, that's wonderful. God, that's wonderful. We talked quite a lot about Auden as well, and we said that Manise died relatively young. I've got a clip here of Auden reading the end of his poem, The Cave of Making, in memoriam Louis MacNeice, in 1965. And Auden, obviously, very struck by the loss of a friend, but also the loss of a contemporary, and saw MacNeice's death as the moment that he, Auden, needed to recommit to poetry, that he felt that he had lost focus after he moved to the States. So this is recorded, I think, relatively close to when the poem was written.
I wish you hadn't caught that cold, but the dead we miss are easier to talk to. With those no longer tensed by problems, one cannot feel shy. And anyway, when playing cards or drinking or pulling faces are out of the question, what else is there to do but talk to the voices of conscience they have become? From now on, as a visitor who needn't be met at the station, your influence is welcome at any hour in my ubiquity, especially here where titles from poems to the burning perch offer proof positive of the maker you wear, with whom I once collaborated, once at a weird symposium, exchanged winks as a Juggins went on about alienation. Seeing you know our mystery from the inside, and therefore how much in our lonely dens we need the companionship of our good dead, to give us comfort on dowry days when the self is a nonentity dumped on a mound of nothing, to break the spell of our self-enchantment when lip-smacking imps of Mork and Hui write with us what they will. You won't think me imposing if I ask you to stay at my elbow until cocktail time. Dear Shade, for your elegy, I should have been able to manage something more like you than this egocentric monologue, but accept it for friendship's sake.
God, that's beautiful as well.
That's very, very...
But actually, he's wrong at the end. I was thinking how, unlike some Auden, maybe unlike late Auden, that is.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it nods to MacNeice's immediacy and simplicity, and doesn't have any of that, you know, glory in the completely incomprehensible word that that Auden would love.
Isn't that the thing that I go back to MacNeice again and again, because he just feels like I don't really, you know, the poetry, you read the poetry, he remains mysterious. He remains someone that you feel that you would absolutely want to spend an evening with and talk to.
Good evening.
And have so much of his work was working with other people's work. I mean, that always interests me, all the play adaptations.
It's always a good sign in an artist if they're a good collaborator.
And the lack of... That's the thing about Autumn Journal. For somebody who was 31 when he wrote it, you know, the lack of disfiguring egotism and grandstanding is just seems remarkable. It remains through collected poems. There isn't a sort of a... There's not a lot of up and down. You know, there isn't a great late flowering. He hit his stride and did what he did brilliantly until he stopped.
His public profile, though, goes up near the end of his life.
Yeah.
That it's perceived, I think, that the last volume, The Burning Perch, which is published 3 days after his death.
Yeah.
It was due to go, clearly, anyway. But he died because he wanted some sound effects for a play and wanted to make sure they were right, so went down a pothole in Yorkshire, came out sopping wet, went to the pub to warm up, caught pneumonia and died. So, John, you're right, though. He's working right up to the end. He remains productive right up to the end.
Mm. I was just thinking about the final part of this poem, which is a lullaby, really.
Yeah.
So I love, and they're so the self-erasing poetic form spoken so that no one can hear it anymore. And there's something really quietly composed about
so
ending.
We're going to go out on the voice of Louis McNeice himself, but before we hear that, Sam, could you give us the end of Autumn Journal? Sophie was just talking about.
I'm going to read this from a first edition that I was given on my 50th birthday by my dear friend Helen Mountfield, who is a fellow poetry lover, and I want to say that because our mutual love of this poem has been with us since we were at university together. I think one of the shocking things that stayed about with me at this poem is that every time I read it, it seems to be more up to date.
that is the takeout quote. I love it. That's exactly right.
And so every time you go back to it, you think, oh God, this is horribly relevant.
Yeah.
So politically, this isn't a bit about love. It's about who we want to be, which is maybe a question we might be asking ourselves a bit more nowadays. What is it we want, really? For what end and how? If it is something feasible, obtainable, let us dream it now and pray for a possible land not of sleepwalkers, not of angry puppets, but where both heart and brain can understand the movements of our fellows, where life is a choice of instruments and none is debarred his natural music, where the waters of life are free of the ice blockade of hunger and thought is free as the sun, where the altars of sheer power and mere profit have fallen to disuse, where nobody sees the use of buying money and blood at the cost of blood and money, where the individual, no longer squandered in self-assertion, works with the rest, endowed with the split vision of a juggler and the quick lock of a taxi, where the people are more than a crowd. So sleep in hope of this, but only for a little. Your hope must wake while the choice is yours to make, the mortgage not foreclosed, the offer open. Sleep serene, avoid the backward glance, go forward, dreams. Sleep serene, avoid the backward glance, go forward, dreams, and do not halt. Behind you in the desert stands a token of doubt, a pillar of salt. Sleep the past and wake the future, and walk out promptly through the open door. But you, my coward doubts, may go on sleeping. You need not wake again, not anymore. The new year comes with bombs. It is too late to dose the dead with honourable intentions. If you have honour to spare, employ it on the living. The dead are dead as 1938. Sleep to the noise of running water, tomorrow to be crossed, however deep. This is no river of the dead or Lethe. Tonight we sleep on the banks of Rubicon. The die is cast. There will be time to audit the accounts later. There will be sunlight later. And the equation will come out at last.
There really is nothing to be said after that. Thank you, Sam. How do you end a long poem? Well, I would say, right, just like that. Beautiful. As you say, that idea, each time you go back to this poem, it seems like it's written more recently. A great credit to poetry, but a great credit also to what McNeice has done. That's all we have time for. So I want to thank Sam and Sophie and Nikki, our producer, and Unbound, our sponsor.
You can download all 76 backlisteds, plus follow up all the links, clips and suggestions for further reading on our website, backlisted.fm, and of course you can still contact us on Twitter, Facebook and Boundless. We've really enjoyed this week talking into phones. If you feel like returning our equipment, however, that would be good too. Please consider leaving a review with stars if you feel so moved on iTunes or whichever platform from which you obtain your oral pleasure.
Thank you, folks. We'll be back in a fortnight.
We're going to leave you with the voice. We've talked about him. You've heard his friends talking about him, his lovers talking about him, and us talking about him. We're going to leave you with the voice of Louis McNeice himself, both explaining and then declaiming a little bit of his poem, Bagpipe Music.
Here is a poem which I wrote towards the end of the 1930s during a visit to the Western Isles of Scotland. It's a poem which on the surface is a nonsense poem, It's called bagpipe music, and technically one of the points about it was to try and suggest by the sound of the lines the noise of the bagpipes. It's no go the herring board, it's no go the Bible. All we want is a packet of fags when our hands are idle. It's no go the picture palace, it's no go the stadium. It's no go the country cot with a pot of pink geraniums. It's no go the government grants, it's no go the elections. Sit on your ass for 50 years and hang your hat on a pension. It's no go my honey love, it's no go my poppet. Work your hands from day to day, the winds will blow the profit. The glass is falling hour by hour, the glass will fall forever. But if you break the bloody glass, you won't hold up the weather.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.